Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our weekly Con Law podcast. We are now entering week 13. This is Jenny joining you for one of our two last episodes regarding our course material. So for week 13, we are going to delve into the constitutional law around the United States government and the Native American tribes, which are a distinct and separate political entity that has its own power, its own sovereignty. But that is a heavily, heavily contested topic and has been for pretty much the entirety of U.S. history. Please take a moment to go to the Week 13 roadmap page and open up the slides on tribal government and power. And when you have a chance to do that, click over to slide 2, which has our objectives for this week, including us getting an introduction to a huge range of topics around tribal government. I mean, if we were to really delve into this, this could be a 16-week course all on its own. So we are going to be very high level in our conversation this week. We are also going to talk about 5 different cases related to Native American tribes and power, and a lot of the focus there is going to be on criminal justice and the Indian Child Welfare Act, also known as ICWA. So let's get right to it. First and foremost, the Constitution provides 2 specific references to the tribes that really highlight them as independent political entities separate from the government structure set up by the Constitution. The first is in the discussion of apportionment, where we are talking about representation. And there it says, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. So here we're simply saying, in terms of counting people in your population, you will not count those individuals who qualify as at that time under the label of Indians. Turning to the Commerce Clause, we also have a statement that sets aside the tribes as something distinct and independent. Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So again, this becomes a distinct political entity that lives on its own. But how we talk about that entity really does evolve, particularly early with constitutional law. So turning to slides 4, 5, and 6, we're going to go over the language around the tribes and how they were described as a political entity in 3 separate cases, all taking place within the early 1800s. So in Johnson versus McIntosh from 1823, the case law there talks about the tribes having rights to complete sovereignty as independent nations, okay? But aside from that, they were saying those independent nations had no power over land grants because they had been conquered. Conquest gives a title which the courts of this conqueror cannot deny. Yeah, that's a pretty big pushback on the power and authority of the tribes. But there is a notion here of complete sovereignty as independent nations. That is quite a distinct setup and quite a distinct recognition of the power of the tribes to have authority in a lot of respects. Complete sovereignty, we are going back to that notion of who has the power, who has the ability to impose their order and their rules. And when you have complete sovereignty, you have complete control over that. But of course, what we're saying here is they don't have complete control over land. So it's a back and forth in that case as far as the decision and the opinion. Turning to Cherokee Nation versus Georgia in 1831, there's a very, very different characterization of the tribes in terms of them as a political entity. Here, they are seen as domestic dependent nations, and the language in the opinion says, their relation to the United States resembles that of a ward to his guardian. So this is so very, very different than what was just said 8 years before in Johnson versus McIntosh. We're now talking about dependencies. And a ward to a guardian, well, wards don't have power and authority over themselves. They would not be sovereigns. Their guardians would be the sovereign in this case, and they might delegate powers to the ward, or they might give them some, you know, authority. But this is very much framing it more like a parent and a child. And we don't tend to identify children as independent, sovereign entities that have power and authority in and of themselves. Yes, they do with respect to some things, but generally speaking, there are lots and lots of limits on that power. The third case which addresses this comes in 1832, and it's incredibly famous as a case. Now, the reason for its fame is because of the way the executive and President Andrew Jackson actually responds to the court. Wooster versus Georgia, 1832, actually is what initiates the actions known as the Trail of Tears, where the executive pushes a huge number of different tribes off of their native lands. What had been recognized by the court in that case was that the Indian nations were independent political communities, retaining their original natural rights, as the opinion notes. The case facts in Wooster v. Georgia are that Samuel Wooster is a Christian missionary. There are non-Native Americans like him living and working in what is the Cherokee Territory in Georgia. And the missionaries are actually advising the Cherokee on how to push back on the state of Georgia, how to resist the state laws that were being imposed upon them. Wooster and the others are then brought under indictment for violation of Georgia law that prohibits non-Native Americans from living with the Cherokee without a license. So we are very, very particular here about who can live on Cherokee land. The Supreme Court in Wooster rules 5-1 that Georgia's laws are unconstitutional. They're void. They don't get to stand. And it's Chief Justice Marshall who writes the opinion that includes this very important language that's captured on slide 6. The Indian nations had always been considered as distinct, independent political communities retaining their original natural rights. That's a huge, huge acknowledgement of the power and authority of the tribes. And President Jackson, in pushback, says what's probably one of his more famous quotes: Marshall has made his decision, now let's see him enforce it, or something to that effect. Of course, history may be lost to us in terms of the really formal wording, but in essence, the executive wasn't going to listen to the judiciary on this. They were going to trample all over that decision and, again, enforced the Trail of Tears, which led to the deaths of so many members of the tribes that were forced to relocate to Oklahoma. This is probably one of the most profound cases that we've looked at where there is such clear pushback on the Supreme Court and its decision, because it's not only President Jackson who pushes back, it's the state of Georgia. And what, again, follows is 20 years of executive policy that flies in the face of this opinion. And since that time, we've just seen a whole lot of contest over the tribes and their authority and power, and essentially what Congress decides to allocate to them versus what the Supreme Court recognizes, and the debate back and forth over that. That debate is what gets captured a little bit here in the quote on slide 7. For all internal purposes, the tribes are sovereign and free from state intrusion on that sovereignty unless Congress explicitly acts to grant the states this power. So our contest moving from the 1830s is not just about the balance between the federal government and the tribes, but also between the state governments and the tribes. What can the states do? Where are they sovereign? Where is the federal government sovereign? And where are the tribes sovereign? What is each government's areas of authority? Sovereignty is so highly contested in these cases because we are talking about powers that are ultimately about who has the final say. So early on in the history of the tribes and the federal government, there were a couple of general principles that get announced in different cases. And these principles are supposed to be what is guiding the Supreme Court's decisions around any contests or any cases that come before them related to the power of the tribes. So slide 8 captures the principles. Point 1, treaties, agreements, statutes, and executive orders are to be determined liberally in favor of the tribes, meaning that if there is a case or a contest or some sort of debate over the power, the interpretation that the court is supposed to go with is that which is most beneficial to the tribes. So we kind of encountered the same dynamic when we were thinking about administrative law. And under the pre-existing Chevron doctrine, what the court was going to do was defer to the administrative agencies if their interpretation or explanation was reasonable. Here, what we're going to do is defer to the explanation or interpretation that is most beneficial to the tribes. We're still going to defer on some level, but we're going to be thinking about which approach is most consistent with this liberally in favor of the tribes. Now, that also implicates the federal government in terms of it needs to act in the best interest of the tribes. But what do we mean when we say in the best interest? That has evolved significantly over time, and I've captured a few snips or screenshots on slide 9 to give us a sense of what in the best interest means. If we talk about 1900 or prior to that point in time, in the best interest meant pushing Native Americans and the tribes to become more civilized, to become more like the dominant white culture of the time. What this would mean at the time around 1900 is that you would take Native children, like the 3 Lakota boys pictured on the left, and you would put them into schools. You would take them from the tribes and you would place them in these boarding schools, these reform schools, and push them to become more, again, like the dominant culture. This was considered in the best interest. The picture on the right-hand side is where we mark a shift. And this is 1924, President Calvin Coolidge is signing the Indian Citizenship Act, which grants citizenship to Native Americans. This is a big step in reflecting on and extending citizenship, but also granting some sort of recognition of power and authority. Again, we now have rights recognized as associated with the tribes. Being citizens of the United States, that does somewhat place the best interest somewhere between having independent authority and power and also being recognized as members of the country with the inherent rights and protections of being a U.S. citizen. The notion of best interest evolved long after this. So what we have are pictures from 1900 and 1924, but you have the American Indian Movement, or AIM, in the 1960s and 1970s. There is shifting opinion in the federal government about how much power and authority to delegate to the tribes, and there's recognition of different dynamics that have affected the tribes in their future, particularly with laws like the Indian Child Welfare Act. That act, again known as ICWA, passes in 1978, and it focuses on when you remove a Native American child or a member of a tribe who is a child and place them somewhere else, there has to be some priority placed on putting them back with the tribe because of the long history, again, as cataloged in these pictures, of taking children from the tribes, placing them into schools, and educating them in a way that returning to the tribe was made functionally impossible for those individuals. So let's compare and contrast a little bit of the then and now. And by then, I mean we're talking mostly about the 1800s or early 1900s, and we're going to evaluate that in comparison with very recent cases, including some of our layman's terms cases. So let's talk about land, a huge discussion, debate, one of the more heavily contested topics early in the 1800s. When we get to the case of Fletcher versus Peck, which was discussed in our last episode relating to the power of the states with respect to federalism. What is announced in that case in relation to the tribes, completely separate from the contract discussion, is that tribes possessed a right of occupancy, but they don't have the title to the land. So you have to get consent before occupancy can be overridden or terminated. And yet in that case, as we know, the Supreme Court said, nope, you can't overrule contracts. So even though this land was taken in a way that should never have happened, we're still going to honor the contracts for the people who purchased it, thereby dispossessing the tribes of those lands. Now, if we shift to 2020, we're talking a good 200 years down the road. In McGirt v. Oklahoma, which is one of the cases you'll read for this week, the decision says that even if Congress has repeatedly broken promises to the tribes and violated their own treaties, this does not overrule an 1866 treaty, which establishes a huge portion of Oklahoma as part of the Muscogee Nation territory. And in fact, we'll get to a graphic here in these slides later, which shows just how much of eastern Oklahoma really was designated as tribal land. And it's a huge space. And if the tribes have authority in those spaces, that's going to have a lot to say about who gets to make decisions, at least with respect to tribal members. So in order for Congress to change a treaty, they need to have done something to express their intent to create that state power and disestablish the reservation. It's not simply that tribes have a right of occupancy. Is that when Congress has clearly made it known that this is a reservation, unless they've gone back and changed the language and passed something to establish that it's no longer a reservation, that still holds. So 2020 was a big, big shift with respect to Oklahoma, and we've seen a lot of fallout since that point in time. How about we turn to the topic of self-government? Or again, really, this is sovereignty at its core. Who gets to say who governs and over what do they govern? In 1903, we get Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock, where it's the Supreme Court says Congress can get rid of its own treaties without consulting the tribes. It's essentially, nope, we don't have a contract with you. We're going to change our mind about it because Congress has what is called plenary power. Plenary means it's absolute or it's unqualified without limits. So Congress in 1903 is declared to have so much authority and power over the tribes and all Indian affairs, as the language is in that decision. Wow, that is a huge expansion of federal power, a huge taking away from the sovereignty of the tribes. So self-government there, not so much. There is no authority with that. And then in 2004, 100 years later, we are at U.S. versus Lara. The case details of U.S. versus Lara are going to take us in an interesting direction because we're going to be thinking about criminal charges and double jeopardy. But the crucial element that relates to self-government in this case is that the courts are going to say that the tribe's power of self-government includes the authority over criminal jurisdiction. It's criminal jurisdiction over all Indians, including the non-members of their tribes. They're explicitly going out to say that tribes are self-governing, sovereign political communities. They can go ahead and assert that power and authority as long as it's consistent with federal law and policy. But at its core, we are saying the tribes have authority, their power of self-government, and that authority includes overseeing criminal cases and criminal matters. So that's where self-government comes in with U.S. versus Lara. When you read the case, it's going to go in a pretty different direction because, again, we're going to end up talking about things like double jeopardy and that clause and what it means there. But don't lose sight of where the opinion talks about self-government matters. A third topic area in which we have delved a lot over the history, and this may be more extensive than quite a few others, not so much land or self-government, but definitely things like child placement, criminal justice. Criminal justice has been so highly contested because we don't know who can actually prosecute an individual tribe member or even a non-tribe member on a reservation. That has been what is contested. It depends if that non-member is a member of any tribe or is not a tribal member in any way, shape, or form. But let's go back to Ex parte Crow Dog. Ex parte Crow Dog, 1883. One tribal member, Crow Dog, kills another tribal member on a reservation. Okay. It's the killing of a Native American who is not a member of his tribe at that point in time. And when the case goes forward, the Supreme Court says Congress didn't give federal courts the power to bring a Native American to trial for the murder of another Native American on a reservation. The reservations are the lands overseen by the tribes. And therefore, that should be something that goes through tribal courts or whatever is in place to prosecute the individuals. So interestingly enough, what Crow Dog had done was, of course, murder an individual, but he'd made reparations to the family of his victim. He had been ordered by the tribal government of the Great Sioux Reservation where the murder occurred to pay restitution to the family, and he did. And yet after that point in time, the government of the Dakota Territory, where all of this is happening, actually goes after him, charges him with murder, finds him guilty, sentences him to death. And the entire question is, does that process get allowed to go forward? The court's absolutely unanimous in this decision. It's a 9-0. And they said that the 1868 treaty that's in place doesn't give the federal government the ability to do that. It's when we are talking about the tribes and the Indians that we have to allow for their process. And you can't push this into the federal court's realm. The case from now is another of our layman's terms, 2022 Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta. This is a contest that follows on from McGirt versus Oklahoma, where we've now established that a large proportion of Oklahoma is still a reservation. So what happens if you've been previously convicted by the federal government and you've now learned that perhaps they weren't in power to do that, and that's not how this process should have happened. So just in terms of the facts of the case, Castro Huerta is not a tribal member, but he is responsible for committing a crime against a tribal child. And that brings in all sorts of questions as to who gets to manage and handle this case. Is it the state of Oklahoma? Is it the federal government? Is it the tribal government? How are we going to proceed here? I would ask you to go ahead and read the syllabus in this case. Dig into this one. It's going to set up a lot of follow-up between what is state power and authority or state jurisdiction versus tribal jurisdiction. And again, this is something that is so very recent. We're talking in the last few years, so there is a lot of contested status. And we can see that also reflected in slide 13, where we are going back and forth on the conflicted status of states and tribes. In 1959, you have Williams versus Lee, which is a merchant who is selling goods on a reservation, attempts to hold some people accountable for not paying for those goods, and tries to take them to state court, and the Supreme Court shuts that down. State courts do not have jurisdiction in this case. Same general conclusion in 1973 with McClanahan versus Arizona State Tax Commission. So Arizona has no power to impose taxes on the income of Navajo Indians who are living on the Navajo reservation if their income is wholly coming from reservation sources. Okay, if it's coming from something else, Arizona can step in and do that, but really we're going to put the limits on state jurisdiction here with respect to those two particular cases. And then we get to 1988 with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. Now, to be very clear, the IGRA is a congressional act. It's passed in October of 1988. It sets up the National Indian Gaming Commission. And essentially, okay, so if you're going to have casinos, you're going to gamble, you're going to have to follow and adhere to the IGRA, because again, this is Congress stepping in to put down its foot on the issue of gaming, gambling, anything that you can see as far as a gambling structure with respect to reservations. So this is an intervention where it's not necessarily there's a case here, but it does start to come into play with respect to later cases, in particular Seminole Tribe of Florida versus the state of Florida. So what's interesting about the Seminole Tribe case is not necessarily the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which is at kind of the heart of this, right? Florida is pushing back on the Seminole Tribe's actions, and what the Seminole Tribe says is the IGRA, not in and of itself, has anything content-wise that we need to worry about, but this says the states have to act in good faith. Like, they have to follow through on what the regulations say the states should do. And they take Florida to the Supreme Court. They try to sue, right? And we're going to come back here to something that we've seen before with the case of Alden versus Maine, state sovereign immunity. So in that case, the question that comes before the Supreme Court is not about the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act at all. It's, can this tribe sue the state of Florida? Or is that prohibited under state sovereign immunity? And is that protected under the 11th Amendment, which would supersede the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act? And the Supreme Court says, well, the IGRA did undercut state sovereignty, but the Commerce Clause doesn't give Congress that power. So Congress can't do this. The 11th Amendment is going to stand here. So the Seminole Tribe cannot sue the state of Florida unless the state of Florida agrees to it, right? They have to step down and say, we're going to allow you to file a lawsuit against us. We're declining our state sovereign immunity, and we're just going to roll with that. Which is such an interesting concept, right? Like, under the 11th Amendment, someone has to allow you to sue them, to take them to court if they're a state. Pretty hard to imagine states are going to sign off on that very much. The final case listed on this slide is Carcieri versus Salazar. Forgive my pronunciation, but I'm going to attempt to describe this. The Narragansett Indian tribe in 1991 is purchasing some land. This is in Rhode Island. They're trying to build a housing complex for the elderly, and they do this under a Department of Interior Act. It's coming from or tied back to the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act, okay? So the tribe is trying to make this action because they're trying to, again, build something for elderly housing. They're putting it under federal and tribal control. This is in the 1990s. But the Indian Reorganization Act is dating back to 1934, and this specific tribe was not recognized as a tribe until 50 years after that. So this tribe doesn't fall under the Indian Reorganization Act and therefore should not be allowed to make this move. So Rhode Island is pushing back. The state is pushing back on the tribe attempting to buy this land. And the U.S. Department of Interior is acting to support the tribe. So we have, again, this back and forth between states, tribes, and the federal government is intervening here on behalf of the tribe. And so the legal question that ends up happening to come to the court is about whether the federal government has the ability to do this for the tribe if the tribe was recognized after the act. The Supreme Court says no. No, this act didn't apply to a tribe that's not recognized until 50 years later, so they don't have the power to do this. The states can push back. So you see this trend prior to the 1988 Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, where the tribes gain and the tribes win. And then in the 1990s and the 2000s, the tribes are losing more to the states. States are asserting their authority much more effectively and powerfully in the Supreme Court. One final element to highlight in this conversation before we get to talking more about the layman's terms cases or the specific cases is that these cases around tribal sovereignty often get more complicated because they pull in things we've already talked about in relation to federalism between the national government and the states. So that 1973 case brings in the issue of preemption, whether the federal government has declared it intends to occupy the space of the reservations and taxing authority or not. And then for this case of Holland versus Brackeen, which is one that I've asked you to take a look at as a layman's terms case, the question there is about whether ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, commandeers the states. Does it violate the 10th Amendment? There is a lot of complexity in these cases because of the way that we have structured the power relationship between the federal government and the tribes, and then tried to define that relationship also with respect to the states. It's been contentious between the federal government and the states, and it will and remains contentious between the states and the tribes as well. And in particular, what you see from the cases in the 2020s era, as in 2022, 2020, This really emerges in the state of Oklahoma. Before we delve into the chaos that is Oklahoma law around tribal authority and power, let's step back to 2004, this United States versus Lara case. Now, if you go to the OYA website, you're going to get some nice facts of the case, but I'd really encourage you to stick with reading what is in your textbook on this topic. Suffice it to say, what's happening here is Billy Joe Lara is not super keen on his treatment. And he's arrested on the Spirit Lake Reservation. That is what is pictured on the slide, slide 15. So the Spirit Lake Reservation is actually located in North Dakota. And as some of you may know, quite large areas of South Dakota are reservations. We have some pretty significant spaces in the southwestern portions of the United States, particularly Arizona. These are pretty sizable pieces of land. And what happens on that land is really going to be important to defining who has authority and power. Where do these events take place? And again, who gets to assert their authority based on the location, or even based in criminal cases on who the victim is and who the perpetrator is? So we're talking heavily in the criminal justice realm. Billy Joe Lara, this is a public intoxication issue. He's arrested on the reservation. He is not a member of the tribe, not a member of that reservation. Suffice it to say, Mr. Lara does not behave so well, and you can see some of this in the facts of the case. If you don't see it in the textbook, go ahead and, again, look that up on the OYA.org website. He goes before a tribal court, and then he's brought before a federal court. So he's got assault charges in two different courts, and this would seem to be a problem, at least under the Fifth Amendment, according to Mr. Lara. So as you're reading through this case, what's difficult about this one is we have a couple of different things going on, and it's easy to really fall into focusing on the double jeopardy issues that come up, which are very, very engaging. I do enjoy the opinion section where we're talking about whether this is a violation of double jeopardy or not, but focus instead on this question about sovereignty, right? Sovereignty and the power to bring criminal charges. Who has the power to prosecute? Particularly individuals who are non-members of the tribe or non-members who live on that reservation. What does that mean for the power of the tribes? Our second layman's terms case, keeping in that same vein of criminal justice, and that's where we're going to stay for four of the five cases that we're going to cover in this section of our material, McGirt versus Oklahoma. Now, this is not a fun case to read about. When you get to the case facts, we are talking about sex crimes and sexual assault against a child. It's not a happy story by any means, but what is interesting about this case isn't necessarily the criminal conduct, but who gets to hold Mr. McGirt responsible for that conduct. Now, what I've grabbed as a kind of picture to go with this case on slide 16 is the tribal reservations that were recognized since the Supreme Court decision in McGirt. And you can see there are huge tracts of land in Oklahoma, defined as the Chickasaw Nation, the Muscogee Nation, the Choctaw Nation, the Cherokee Nation, the Seminole Nation, the Quapaw Nation, and these include major cities in Oklahoma, like Tulsa, which is on the Muscogee Nation Reservation. And when that is the case, we are going to have to consider whether this still belongs to that tribe or nation. And that's really what is going to be the fundamental point of contention in McGirt versus Oklahoma, because Mr. McGirt is going to challenge being brought to court by a specific authority. He is not going to say that he can't be brought to court for criminal behavior. He's going to say the state of Oklahoma can't do that. And that's really at the heart of this case. And what happens with this decision is the Supreme Court really throws into the air all sorts of, well, ongoing criminal prosecutions and investigations. Because if the state of Oklahoma isn't recognized as the right authority to hold people criminally accountable, oof, what do we do with all of the cases that already went through using this approach? And that's going to come up later in Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta. You might experience a bit of a boomerang feeling kind of effect with Dinesh P. v. United States and subsequently Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta, because we're going to be revisiting the same topics as what was in U.S. v. Lara and McGirt v. Oklahoma. So U.S. v. Lara, while it's about sovereignty, it also includes the issue of double jeopardy, which, conveniently enough, is where Dinesh P. really comes into play. So we're again talking about a double jeopardy clause because we're not sure who gets to prosecute an individual for assault. It's literally assault again. U.S. v. Lara is about assault. Merle Dinesh P. in Dinesh P. versus United States has an assault charge that he's dealing with. That is where the similarities kind of die out, however, because in the Dinesh P. case, we are not talking about assault on a federal officer. We are talking about sexual assault. As you read through the opinion in this case, which is the resource I've recommended here, it's 30 pages, which is 30 pages in a PDF format of a Supreme Court decision, which honestly comes down to reading closer to, I would say, roughly 15 pages, because the actual text in the body of the PDF is pretty small. But that being said, it's about 15 pages that you're going to read, and I want you to focus on key concepts they reference, like dual sovereignty here, because dual sovereignty is going to come into play. Of course, we've got double jeopardy again, but I think that that's kind of one of those things where I'm going to say focus instead on the dual sovereignty component and the way that they talk about that, because that is really where we get into tribal authority and power with respect to the arena of criminal justice. In slide 18, I do highlight some language about double jeopardy, which is extremely interesting. The double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment provides no person shall be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. But in the opinion, what they write is that the clause by its terms does not prohibit twice placing a person in jeopardy for the same conduct or actions. Interesting language written by Justice Barrett in this case. And I think a lot of people, if they reflect on that separate from the dual sovereignty concept, would say that seems to be a violation of double jeopardy. I mean, we are using the same set of actions, but as per the interpretation of the court, as long as it's not the same offense, it does not violate the double jeopardy clause. Turning to the last of our criminal justice cases, this is Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta, 2022. Another criminal justice case that when you delve into the case facts, it's not one of those happy-feely cases. Generally speaking, when cases make it to the Supreme Court and it's a criminal justice matter, it's not one that you will walk away feeling positive about. I just want to be real upfront and honest about that when it comes to constitutional law and the cases that we emphasize. Mr. Castro Huerta, pictured here on slide 19, is facing 35 years of imprisonment for child neglect. The victim is his stepdaughter, who is a member of the Cherokee tribe. And you can go ahead and delve into, again, the Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta opinion. That is what is posted here. Please read the syllabus and pages 1 through 16 of that opinion. It goes up to where section 2 is listed on that page, on page 16. Again, this is not going to be a feel-good kind of read, but what I want you to focus in on is where are we redefining the boundaries now with respect to Oklahoma and what it can prosecute in terms of crimes versus what it cannot? And who is involved? Are we changing our definitions and understandings of the criminal justice process depending on Mr. Castro Huerta, who is not a member of a tribe, or based on the victim? Where do we draw these lines? Justice Kavanaugh writes this opinion. We do have some interesting dissenting opinions. I've always enjoyed Justice Gorsuch's dissenting opinions in these cases. He is widely recognized as a profound authority when it comes to laws with respect to the tribes and the reservations. And so what you'll see written here from him is quite different from what you get in the majority opinion. And I've even captured just a little bit of it on slide 20. So Gorsuch, again, writing for his dissent, he writes in a way that is actually also pretty understandable. And what he says in his opinion, where this court once stood firm, today it wilts. After the Cherokee's exile to what became Oklahoma, the federal government promised the tribe that it would remain forever free from interference by state authorities. Only the tribe or the federal government could punish crimes by or against tribal members on tribal lands. At various points in its history, Oklahoma has chafed at this limitation. Now, the state seeks to claim for itself the power to try crimes by non-Indians against tribal members within the Cherokee Reservation. Where our predecessors refused to participate in one state's unlawful power grab at the expense of the Cherokee, today's court accedes to another's. The language there is a little bit technical, but Gorsuch is making a pretty powerful stand on where he feels the line has been drawn with respect to state power on these types of prosecutions, and how we are distinctively taking a different approach as of 2022. The final case I would like to have you look at this week is Holland versus Brackeen from 2023 involving the Indian Child Welfare Act. Now you'll see there's a slide in which I've included just a snippet of the oral arguments offered there. You can find those again on OYA if you look up the case. It's an interesting series of arguments and pretty contentious, to be honest. What you can also see in the slide 21 is the couple that was attempting to adopt a Native American child, Chad and Jennifer Brackeen. They are suing Deb Holland, who is the Department of the Interior Secretary at that point in time. And this is all going to go back to ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act. And there's a few snips later in the slides about what the elements are of that. On slide 23, I've listed the language with respect to placement of Indian children and specifically adoptive placements, which is what we're considering in this case. And with those adoptive placements, there are preferences in the law. And it reads, in any adoptive placement of an Indian child under state law, a preference shall be given in the absence of good cause to the contrary to the placement with a member of the child's extended family, other members of the Indian child's tribe, or other Indian families. And that is what is written in. And again, the ICWA language is a congressionally passed statute. So this is federal law. And while it may seem it's really just about one couple challenging the law, really the state of Texas is going to step in here and try to assert its power and authority because it's going to talk about the concept of commandeering. Now, before we get further into talking about those minor details, let's talk about the good cause exceptions that exist under ICWA, because in that first bit of language, we're saying in the absence of good cause to the contrary. So perhaps under the law, the couple that wants to do this adoption already has a good cause exception. Well, here are the good cause exceptions listed on slide 24. There's good cause if there is a request of one or both of the child's parents, if they attest that they have reviewed the placement options that comply with the order of preference, maybe the child is requesting it if they're old enough and they can understand what decision is being made, whether there's a sibling involved and that's going to be affecting the placement, if there are extraordinary physical, mental, or emotional needs of the child, which would require specialized treatment, and that might not be available if we go with one of those other placements, or the lack of a suitable placement after a determination by the court that there was an actual search conducted to find suitable placements, and they don't meet the criteria, right? We don't have any other really good options. That would be a good cause situation where you could place an Indian child or a tribal child with a non-Native American family. And that's what's going to come up in the discussion of this case. But again, really, the legal question isn't going to be as much about ICWA as it is going to be on some level about whether this is a law that commandeers states to behave in a certain way. go back to the opinion. I've asked you in this case simply to read the syllabus because the Holland versus Brackeen case is an extremely long opinion. It's 133 pages. The syllabus is going to take you through about pages 1 through 8. And I want you to focus there on anything about non-delegation, something else we've talked about, commandeering. Where are we seeking the balance again between states and tribes? It's easy again to kind of see there's multiple things that the court is dealing with in this case. The Indian Child Welfare Act for sure is an important point, but the court's going to talk a lot about prior cases and things like the anti-commandeering doctrine, which we saw in Prince. So as you are working through each of these cases, please let me know if you have any questions or concerns. A few last minute reminders for what is coming up. Our final layman's terms handouts will be due this week, this weekend to be very, very exact. And after that, you have no more submissions to make on that front, which is awesome because then we only have about 3 to 4 weeks of class left. Make sure that you skim, if you cannot read, but skim chapters 11 and 12 on the contract clause and economic due process. Those are our last bits of material, which I will post next week. And then keep making progress on your final papers. I will have feedback to your initial drafts by early next week so that you can incorporate that in the final drafts. Keep up the great work. I know that this class is difficult. It's a slog because we are encountering a lot of heavy and important and extremely complicated concepts. But as long as you do your best to work through it, I can promise you I recognize and see that effort, and you will not walk away failing this course. Keep at it. Let me know what questions you have so that I can get back to you and help clarify. And as always, if you have anything else you want to have me assist with, please email me at jemille1@wsc.edu. Thanks all, and have a great rest of your week.